This case has two interesting issues in it. Once again, I'm Barry McCracken. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Smith from the Public Defender's Office in Norfolk. And as always, it's a pleasure to be here. There are two assigned errors. To save time, I know you're familiar with the case and the facts that, you know, they both have very finely drawn legal points. I think as to the first assignment of error, it deals with whether or not there was a violation of due process and failing to provide Mr. Smith with the right to confront and cross-examine the detective that generated the photographs, which are which constitute the bulk of that very salacious sealed appendix. And I apologize for that, but it's the only way to do these kind of cases, so there it is. Insofar as that issue, it was clearly well preserved. And the issue becomes, was it testimony? First issue is, was this testimonial hearsay? Clearly it was. I mean, this is no different than the lab technician coming from the Department of Forensic Evidence to testify about what tests were run to ballistics test, drug test, any other test.
And there's a requirement to find good cause, and no finding was made.
No finding was made. Now, let me point out, I mean, I noticed in the AG's brief, they said, well, the Henderson court said in some circumstances it's appropriate for the appellate court to take a look at it. The only reason it's appropriate for you to take a look at it under Henderson is because we didn't object to it down below or the court, not, trial court not making those findings. If I read Henderson correctly, just on this point, it's not really before you because I didn't raise it as an assignment of error because my trial attorney failed to object to the court making those findings. But if you read Henderson, what Henderson really says is, look, U.S. Supreme Court said, Marcy, the trier of fact that's doing this is supposed to make that finding on the record. And the trial judge did not do this.
But in Henderson, didn't they make an exception? The Supreme Court made an exception because we hadn't articulated this.
Right, but they now have. What the point is, after Henderson, they have articulated the problem here. The reason we're not talking about that particular problem as an error is because my trial defense attorney didn't say, Judge, you need to make a finding. So, I heard the arguments about 5A18, and y'all have thrown them at me enough. I'm well aware of what it means and how you have to get around it. Nevertheless, since the judge didn't make a finding, your task, like the Henderson court would, was looking at what's here. Now, it seems to me that the AG's argument, first and foremost, is all hinged on the fact that, hey, look, the probation officer looked at those pictures and saw at least the one picture of the couple apparently engaged in sexual intercourse with a small child in the foreground. There's nothing in the record to support the AG's position on that. If you read what the probation officer said, and this is in the record at page 22, at the appendix page is 22, and if you look at what is in the supplemental report at 52, the only pictures the probation officer said they looked at before they gave the phone to the detective to run whatever test he was going to run was a Facebook picture. He said the probation officer's testimony is all the pictures, including the one that came out of the SD card on the camera, were provided by the detective. And that's there's nowhere in the record or in the report that suggests otherwise. The Commonwealth is the Attorney General is suggesting, well, he looked at the picture on the SD card. The record does not support that contention. I don't think it makes any difference. My position is, even if that picture was looked at by the probation officer, apart from whatever else the detective gave him, everything else in that detective's report as to the source of the information, let's not get confused. He talks about, PIN numbers. It's not the picture that's the hearsay. It's the testimony of how it was derived and where it came from and what it meant.
In the context of this case, after all is said and done, isn't it all harmless anyway because the defense counsel had conceded that the travel restriction has nothing to do with the...
Well...
It was sufficient to...
He really didn't concede that, but that's really a different point, Judge, and the reason it's a different point is, A, the question, we would concede that all... Let's set aside the issue about whether or not those... The rules that he's alleged to have violated were properly made and whether or not they applied, and just talk right now about this confrontation issue. If you look at just that, we concede that it you know, the extraction report didn't do anything about any of the travel restrictions, the consumption of alcohol, which were the other violations.
Right.
But it's quite clear the entire focus of why we want to hold him in violation and why she wanted to give him 2 years and 9 months of active incarceration and an additional 10 years of supervised probation was because of those pictures. And she said so on the record. She said so in her report about why she exceeded the guidelines. And I guess in that regard, let me...
What did the trial judge say?
That's what I'm saying. She said, I met the trial judge.
Okay, not the...
She said she was very disturbed by the pictures. You know, and if you read her comment about why she exceeded the guidelines, and I make a reference to it in my brief, and I said record on appeal, page 18. It should have been joint appendix, page 7A. She specifically noted why she went above the guidelines. The court went above the guidelines because of the extremely deserving photographs. I mean, there's no question.
Some of which involved minors.
Are apparently involved minors. There's no, I mean, obviously, I would have to say that unless there was a dwarf, the picture of the couple having intercourse with the child in the foreground, that probably had, but it's debatable whether that's pornographic. Keep in mind, the child is not. The child is in the room, but there's no showing that the child was in any way engaged in the sexual activity or was just not wandering through when the picture was taken. There's a lot of things to argue about that, but that's really not the point when we're talking about the confrontation clause issue. And it does not have any application to the other issues of violation here. But it can't be harmless because basically she said, I'm giving him a whole lot more than I otherwise would, and the whole focus of the Commonwealth's argument, as well as her comments, was that basically notwithstanding whatever else he might have done, she was disturbed by the photographs and the obvious indication that he was involved in the same type of conduct that had got him there in the first place. I mean, the original offense dating back 2 years was possession of child pornography. So, yes, ma'am, sorry.
We're supposed to conduct harmless review in every circumstance where there's a potential for reversal.
Yes, ma'am.
And inasmuch as you're not disputing that there's one and possibly two violations that have absolutely nothing to do with the photos at all, how does...
If it increased his sentence, and clearly that's it, and keep in mind, you can find, just like the probation officer did with these travel restrictions, he just gave him a warning initially. It wasn't a violation. And the judge doesn't have to find him in violation just because he finds that there was conduct there that technically violated a term of his probation. He doesn't have to violate him. And he certainly doesn't have to give him an active period. In this case, I keep saying he, but in this case, the judge was actually a female. She did not have to violate him simply because he had violated the restrictions. The harmless error inquiry really is laid out very succinctly by the Henderson court for these types of situations. I mean, when I think I followed it through in the brief, although I don't know when you saw my name on it, I'm not sure you read that brief. But basically, I think the Henderson court laid out specifically what you were supposed to do. You've got an issue of confrontation. The first question is, should it have been admitted? And, of course, we're saying it shouldn't have been. Then the second question is, would that evidence, along with anything else, show that there was a likelihood that he had committed the violation? But the third inquiry is, without that, would you found him in violation, and would you impose the sanctions that you imposed? And here, it's not clear that had you taken out the photographs, I don't think anybody can say that if there had simply been a question that he had traveled out of an area or that he had consumed a glass of wine at a birthday party, that would have, or that he stayed overnight in a town 5 miles from where he lived, that would have necessarily resulted in a further violation. I don't think this court can say that.
Counsel, respond to the approbate, reprobate.
Well, that has to deal with whether or not the probation officer imposed a sanction. First off, I don't like to throw rocks at my colleagues, but I sometimes, the young attorney that represented this represented my client, did a very good job preserving issues down below. These kind of things come and go all the time. criminal defense, 90% of what you do is sentencing. It may not be everything you do in a case, but pretty much 90% of the cases we do, we know we're going to get to sentencing issues, and we do it very badly. I'm not just talking about the public defender's office. I'm talking about everybody across the board. We don't pay a lot of attention to it. We don't make objections. We don't hold the judge's feet to the fire about things that we should be holding feet to the fire. He said, look, you know, he initially filed stated a motion to strike on the fact that none of the special terms or special instructions given by the probation officer were approved by the court. Well, that included everything that he was charged with violating, including the travel out of state. He then was asked, well, what about that one? And he said, well, you know, I'm really objecting to the fact that these things are beyond standard instructions. Well, there's no standard instructions in this case. There's no standard instructions, no evidence of any standard instructions. The only thing we have is these special instructions given by the probation officer 10 months after the probation order that said you'll comply with whatever the probation officer tells you. And that includes that travel out of state. I don't know what a standard instruction is. I don't think a probation officer has any more authority to issue a standard instruction without intervention by the court than they do a special instruction. Now, you know, that's a question of law, and I disagree with my young counsel's perception of the law down below. He didn't have, but, you know, even if you assume, and I'll include that, or even if you assume that he conceded, you know, it's an interesting thing. We can concede points of law down below, and it does, on appeal you tend to hit me with it. They can concede down below, and you say, oh, we're not bound by concessions of law by the Commonwealth. But even if you assume...
Joint Appendix 3334.
Even if you assume that he conceded that issue, that wasn't before that, and she could violate him for that, I'll go back to the exact same argument I made before. There is nothing that would suggest that if that was the only thing he was being violated for, he would have even been found in violation, or certainly that the sanctions that would have been opposed that she did impose. You cannot get away from this from harmless error. You either got to say it wasn't, you know, you can do what the Douglas court said and say, wait a minute, you should have complained when the judge did this unfettered delegation of authority to the probation officer. When you didn't do that, you waived it. I don't believe that's correct. I think Douglas is wrong. I think for a very simple reason Douglas is wrong is because that wasn't a delegation, that wasn't a condition, that was a delegation of authority. And the delegation of authority is not permitted, and it was void. It wasn't voidable. When the court said, the only restrictions you have is do what this probation officer tells you. It doesn't have to be reasonable. It doesn't have to be based on this defendant, his background, his crime, or the circumstances of this crime, which is what the trial judge is, when he sets a condition of probation, that's what his has to be. That's.
I've said this before to you. You're in your rebuttal time.
I see I've got 2 minutes left. Let me leave that and come back. Maybe there's something I can follow up on. Thanks so much, Judge.
All right, thank you. Mr. Katz.
Good afternoon. I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. I just want to begin by responding to the assertion of the absence of evidence supporting the origin of the photograph of people engaging in sexual intercourse in the presence of children. And I would direct the court to page 28 of the joint appendix. That's clear testimony from the officer that picture is found in the SD card of the phone. That is not a cached web image. I can direct the
court. And that's clear in the exhibit, too, the thumbnail exhibit, too, isn't it?
It is.
You see which ones are noted as cached versus arising from the SD card.
So there's ample evidence before this court that the origin of that evidence is not from a cached web image. The objection at trial is to the process by which those photographs are removed from the web, extracted from the cached image. And as I argue on brief, it conflates evidence that was before the court to which there was no objection, evidence that the investigating officer saw, that there's not a question of how it was obtained or determined, and he was cross-examined on that evidence.
But even that at Joint Appendix 28, it appears to be children, yes, sir. There's an image of children in the room. That was taken from the SD card. The answer, yes, that was taken from the SD card. That was a photograph taken with the phone? I believe so. I'm not 100% sure.
And the follow-up to that wasn't a website. It says that was stored on an SD card. So viewing that evidence in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, The clear implication is that this is not a cached web image. And I would respond that it is incorrect to treat all of that evidence as if it were the same. And the evidence to which there was no objection, the SD card image, corroborates that obtained from the web. So if the court were to engage in the kind of analysis as to whether it was whether the cached web image was testimonial in nature, I would submit that the points that are laid out in Henderson are amply met so as to permit their introduction into evidence.
Does the record give any explanation anywhere as to why the officer who searched through the phone did not testify?
Not that I can find, Your Honor. And I could certainly surmise as to why that would be, but it's not a matter of record evidence.
Mr. Katz, when the probation officer was on the stand, there began to be testimony about the pictures, the ones that arose from the SD card as well as the cached images. There was objection to that made. And obviously we all know as we sit and stand here today, respectively, that the court did not engage in the balancing test at that point before announcing any sort of good cause. But upon the objection, the court then engaged in somewhat of a colloquy with the probation officer. Wasn't that effectively a reliability test at that point in time to determine whether or not the process, as she understood it to be, made the admission of this evidence reliable?
I believe it was, Your Honor. And I think as a result of that colloquy, the court initially sustained a portion of the objection and invited the Commonwealth to ask more pointed questions to get out additional information. So not only was it an effort to engage the reliability of the witness, but it was a successful effort to do so.
Well, don't Henderson and Morrissey require the court now to make an express finding?
I believe so, Your Honor, but clearly the language in Henderson says that it may be inferred by the fact that the court did not do so.
In that one case, anyway.
And I would rely on that, Your Honor, to the extent that this court finds that persuasive. With that, I'd like to turn to the second assignment of error, unless the court has additional questions about the first. I would argue that counsel's efforts on appeal are to analogize to the Wilson case. And as the court, I'm sure, is familiar, that was a case in which this court indicated that the trial court improperly delegated its statutory requirement to determine what restitution was owed. And we have the argument on brief here that the court improperly shifted its burden. I would submit the way that that issue was presented in the trial court was an inappropriate one to preserve that argument for appellate review. What happened in the trial court was a motion to strike attacking the sufficiency of the evidence. Clearly, under 19.2304, the court can address at any point the propriety of a probation obligation. And so if there were a challenge to the method by which that had been done, a motion to dismiss the capias would have been appropriate. An argument as a matter of law that the trial court had not appropriately engaged in its duty would have been appropriate. But a motion to suppress the evidence is not a proper means by which to attack the delegation. And as this court is aware, in resolving that motion, the trial court latched upon other ample evidence that would support the revocation of probation without getting to the issue of, well, what is the trial court required to do? What is the extent of delegation that's proper?
So you disagree with Mr. McCracken that the judge relied primarily on the photos for purposes of the sentence?
I think it is clear that the trial court cites the disturbing nature of the photos in terms of the appropriate revocation. And again, as Mr. McCracken, I think, acknowledged in argument, there are the two issues. There is the delegation issue in assignment of error 2, and was it appropriate to revoke sentence? And then there is the question of, well, if we're analyzing whether it was harmless in admitting those photographs, what does the effect of the sentence have? What can we infer from that? And so I think that addresses his first assignment of error. The court was clearly influenced by the photographs. But that doesn't resolve the fact, was it appropriate or was it an abuse of discretion in the first instance to revoke probation? So I think regardless of the nature of the photographs, the court clearly had authority to do so. It's unchallenged.
And after that, it's just a matter of the sentence that was imposed as a result, and it was within the statutory bounds.
And as I argue on brief, the court's reference to the disturbing photos, I think it must be inferred that is a reference to the photograph that the children are present in. That is what the only photograph that was specifically testified about at the proceeding. And as I argue, I think as page 28 of the Joint Appendix demonstrates, that's not an image from the cached web images. That's an image from the phone itself. And so I think the court acted entirely appropriately in relying on that. And to the extent that that photograph influenced the sentence, that was an entirely appropriate sentence.
Now, the cached images that involve children, unless they are very good actors, as Mr. McCracken talked about earlier, as I recall it, and one of you correct me if I'm wrong, the cached images of the children, while creepy insofar as that's what somebody had downloaded to their phone at some point, they didn't involve any sort of sexual contact or nudity. Is that right? It was just the one of the intercourse in front of the toddler that was on the SD card.
That's my understanding of the evidence, Your Honor. And again, I think
Mr.
that's...
Mr. McCracken, I hope you'll correct me if I'm wrong.
As far as I can tell, Judge, that's correct. I mean, based on what's in the record, I mean, we're all limited to what's actually here. And I think that's a correct statement.
And as I say, I think that's further evidence in support that the trial court was influenced by something that was not the portion of objected to evidence. It was evidence from the phone itself rather than from the cached web image. With that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions the panel may have. Failing that, I'll rely on my brief. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much. Mr. McCracken, you actually have some time left.
Well, you know, this thing about the cash and the SD photo seems to be heavy on the AG's mind as well as on the court's mind. I would simply note that the objections were both to the extraction report and to the addendum. All right, so basically the addendum is the one. And when you read the addendum, I mean, this idea that this thing came off the SD card and therefore the probation officer somehow had accessed it is not supported in the record. I mean, he gave you a look at page 28, but if you read what the report says, after he was arrested, this is on page 52 of the joint appendix. This is in the sealed appendix. After Mr. Smith was arrested, it was taken to Detective Beeson, who works in the computer forensic lab. He ran analysis of the cell phone, and he came up with the photographs, including the ones on purportedly on the SD card. All right, now that's, you know, again, we got two different issues here. The first one is whether or not Detective Beeson should have been called as a witness. And clearly, when you read the testimony, it's not just what's on 28, you got to read the entire testimony, and most of that's on 22. And what he says in his report, it is quite clear that the detective generated all the photographs, including the ones that purportedly came out the SD card. The probation officer said he saw it, but that's because he went back to his office. That's what he said. He went back to his office and pulled up this disc that he'd been provided by the detective. The detective's the one that told him it was on the SD card, and the detective didn't testify. And that's the problem. Now, the second aspect of this about the special conditions and whether or not the judge, you know, basically, she was just finding him guilty of having traveled out of state because it violated a standard instruction. First problem is there are no standard, as I pointed out earlier, there are no standard instructions here. The motion to strike went to the fact that these instructions that he would allegedly violate were out legal effect because they were imposed by the probation officer without intervention of the court, and that applies to everyone in there. This approbate and reprobate, that's always a disturbing concept. It pops up when we can't think of 5A18 problems. But in this case, the judge wasn't misled. He objected to all of the instructions issued by the probation officer, and that included going to North and South Carolina.
But, Mr. McCracken, doesn't the probation officer need to necessarily have some degree of control over what sort of programs or what rules and regulations may need to be imposed on their probationer? If only because, you know, if I'm sentencing your client, I've got the pre-sentence report. I've got what I may have heard during the trial or during the course of the plea of guilty. But the probation officer is going to be the one on the ground floor that needs to impose some things. The question is, ultimately, if the probation officer tries to revoke someone for a condition that has no reasonable relationship with their crime or rehabilitation, and the court becomes the gatekeeper as to whether or not that passes muster.
Well, the problem is the statute says the court's going to do this. And he's going to do it in a hearing. It's not going to be a decision. Keep in mind, none of these special conditions that we're complaining about here were imposed because of anything my client did. They were imposed. Now, I'm not saying that some of them aren't appropriate for my client under this set of circumstances. But what I'm saying is that wasn't the determination of why he got imposed these conditions. It was because he got assigned to a particular team at the probation department, and we give these to everybody. So they're not individualized for this individual. And as Justice Kelsey said recently, that's what's supposed to happen. That's why we don't look at trial judges' sentencing decision. We let them give any sentence, as long as it's a legal one, and put any reasonable term of probation on it, and we don't look at it on appeal, because we've entrusted these judges with the ability to hold these things and individualize probation. He says it's reasonable for the judge to want to rely on the professionals at the probation department. I wholeheartedly agree. But the way you do that is you bring them in the hearing and have them, well, Mr. Probation Officer, what would you do for Mr. Jones over here to make certain that he's properly supervised? Well, Judge, I'd like to have this, this, and this. And then the judge can say, I'll take A and B, and we'll leave C and D off because it doesn't apply in this
but
case.
But sometimes they don't know those things until after they've had their initial meeting.
They can always petition to come back. He says, you know, he could have come back. He could have petitioned to modify it if he thought it was unreasonable. That's what the probation, he's got the ear of the judge. He can always say, look, I've been working with Mr. Smith here, and these restrictions we got him on are not enough, Judge. We need to change them. Right. Now, it means somebody doesn't get to play golf as often as they do, and they got a little busier
well,
docket
down. I think that might be a little unfair to cast that aspersion.
Well, all I'm saying, Judge, is that it will crowd the docket, and it wasn't, and I apologize. It's late in the afternoon, and I was being overly cynical. But it will take. Let's face it, what we're doing in sentencing is we're trusting in the probation department to make up whatever rules and regulations. In this case, when he was put on supervised probation in the first incident, they said he didn't have any rules of probation. The judge just said you're on supervised probation and put him out the door. So there was no delegation of authority. There was simply you're sentenced to, 5 years suspended and you're on 5 years supervised probation. And there were no rules imposed by the court.
I think we follow your argument. I can see why you don't always reserve a whole lot of time.
I just keep going, Judge. I'm like the ever-ready bunny.
At this point, the court will come down and greet counsel, and then we'll take up the Stinney versus the Commonwealth case.
Oh, what?